Welcome to the Coalition for Physician Wellbeing's podcast, The Wellbeing Connector, where through our guests, we explore ideas for making healthcare a better place to work and serve. I'm your host, Dr. Michael Brown. Today, I have the pleasure of having Dr. Dan Diamond on the show. What I love about Dan is how he has thrown himself into such challenging situations. And from these experiences, he has discovered concepts and ideas that we can all use in our daily lives. For years, Dan has been a family physician who repeatedly volunteered for various disaster relief efforts. These included being deployed to the Philippines following Typhoon Yolanda, leading one of the first teams into Haiti after their devastating earthquake, and acting as the director of the medical triage unit in the New Orleans Convention Center following Hurricane Katrina. Dan is a clinical assistant professor at Washington State University School of Medicine. He has also received multiple awards, including the Red Cross Real Hero Award, the Washington State Governor's Award of Excellence, and President Obama's Volunteer Service Award. So thank you, Dan. Thank you. It's a pleasure having you on the podcast today. I'm so glad you could join us.
Thank you, Michael. I appreciate it. It's an honor to be here and to spend time with you. I'm excited about all the work that you've been doing behind the scenes to make this podcast happen. Thank you for your service.
Well, my pleasure. So obviously, you've done so much work in disaster relief. I wanted to start off by just getting a little history from you. How did you get into that and how did that evolve over the years?
You know, this started back when I was in medical school and I thought, well, it'd really be fun to go see the world. So I got permission to do a 3-month rotation in my fourth year in Thailand, working with Hmong refugees in a refugee camp up on the Mekong River. And the way it worked out, I just got married. So 5 days after we got married, we packed our bags up and went to Thailand and stayed there for 3 months. And I thought, man, this is a completely different thing than what they're teaching me in school. And I love it. So I really began having this international view of healthcare. And that was, you know, it's like I got infected. I wanted to go spend time and serve around the world. And it's been a rewarding career. I've been doing this now for 37 years, a little over 37 years.
So can you articulate what made it, what stood out as being so different for you?
Thinking back to when I first arrived in the refugee camp, I had this idea coming through my first couple of years of medical school that people were pretty fragile and that you needed to have all the right tests and equipment to be able to do diagnostic work. And then we get to Thailand and realize that people are really, really tough. And if you have good observation skills, good physical exam skills, you can do a great deal of diagnosis by paying attention to what's going on. We only had x-rays on Monday, Wednesday, and Fridays when the generator worked. And, you know, it didn't always work. So, you know, I remember one time on a Tuesday ordering a chest x-ray on a guy and the tech says to me, oh, sorry, it cannot be. No x-ray today. I thought, oh, yeah, that's right. It's Tuesday. So we lived about an hour away, and we went back and forth by van. I stepped off the van first thing in the morning, and I said to the guy, time for the x-ray. And he goes, so sorry, cannot be. No generator today. Well, we didn't get the x-ray for 3 or 4 days on that guy. But if you really pay attention, there's so much you can get from physical exam. And I definitely came back from that experience a much better diagnostician than I was when I went.
And then you did a bunch of disaster relief over the years. What are some of the places you went to?
Oh my gosh, man. I've been to Mexico, India, Africa. I was the director of the medical triage unit at the New Orleans Convention Center after Hurricane Katrina. That was by far the craziest thing I've ever done. I led first teams into Haiti after their earthquake. The Philippines after Typhoon Yolanda. It's been an amazing career. I've been blessed to be in the right place at the right time multiple times.
And that was all while being a practicing family physician?
Yeah, I had great supportive partners. Disaster would happen. I would hit the eject button. They would fill in. You know, and I've told this to the news when they've interviewed me as I depart for a disaster. When we deploy, We have 24 to 48 hours notice. I hit the eject button. All my patients get rescheduled to my partners. And I could not do any of the work that I did if I didn't have supportive partners, supportive nurses, supporting front office staff that would get on the phone and start rescheduling people. It took an army of people to be able to launch me. It's like, you know, the astronauts that fly in the space shuttle get to do the ride, but everybody else builds the rocket.
Oh, wow.
And that's what it felt like, because there's so many things have to happen so fast in order to deploy rapidly.
I assume your family also had to respond quickly as well.
Oh, yeah. But I married an emergency room nurse.
So, oh, okay.
You know, she was gung-ho. She went to Iraq without me and spent 6 weeks in Iraq and had a heck of an experience. They blew up the building next to her, and it was all kinds of crazy stuff. But,
oh, wow. So it's in the family.
Yeah, it's in the family.
So how did that affect your work when you came back, in terms of not just in terms of missing days, but in terms of how you treated patients and how you reacted to the situation in the office?
I came back from Katrina asking a question that changed my life. And the question was not, why are there so many victims? Because we knew we were going to have a lot of victims. We had, and the media didn't tell you this, but I know it's true. We had 50,000 body bags on pallets.
Wow.
That's a lot of body bags. Unfortunately, we didn't need that many. But so it wasn't the victims that got my attention. It got the attention of the world. It definitely got the attention of the news media. But what got me was asking a different question. What is it about some of these people that, despite losing everything, their homes, their cars, their family members, their clothes, despite losing everything, why is it that some of these people don't become victims? Because I want to sit at their feet and I want to learn, because I'm pretty sure that at that point, if you would have taken my Palm Trio telephone away from me, my world would have collapsed. You know, it's like, oh, my dad is, oh, my contact people are in there. How can I live without that? What if I lost my laptop? You know, and now I think, what if I lose my house? What if I lose a family member? What if COVID hits us? Well, it did. It hit. I lost my father-in-law a couple of days ago.
I'm sorry.
Yeah, it's yeah. So how do you move forward? And what is it about these people that suffer tremendous loss, but they still show up and they say, I have the power to make a difference. It's not about me, and I don't care who gets the credit. How can I help?
So do you have anyone in particular who stood out as a role model in that regard who you can talk about?
Oh, yeah. Oh, my gosh. Juliet Saucy.
Do tell.
Oh, my gosh. So I think we were there probably 3 or 4 days setting up. We set up out in front of the convention center, and we had a bunch of old ragtag tents that I have no idea where they came from. People just dropped them off, and we set them up and made it happen. And some paramedics showed up, and I said, oh, man, I'm glad you're here. I want, you know, one of you to go over here to the red area and get in there and start helping, because we could really use some help with IVs. And then if you could help with triage over here, this would be great. So we, I mean, when Juliet shows up, she's got her EMS uniform on. So she's got blue pants on, navy pants, navy shirt that says New Orleans EMS on the front, little logo, and on the back in big letters, it says paramedic. I said, yeah. If you can come over here, work with Dr. Bob in the red area, help him start some IVs, this would be great. It'd be really helpful. I'm so glad you're here. Thank you so much. She said, yeah, I'm happy to help. She gets in. She starts not only starting IVs, but after a couple hours, I'm looking at her going, wow, you really know stuff. Like, I pulled one of the other local EMS guys aside and I said, hey, is Juliet really a paramedic? And I'll never forget it. He goes, no, Diamond. She's the director of emergency medical services for the whole city of New Orleans. That's Dr. Saucy. I went, oh my gosh, foot in mouth. You know, I went over to her and I said, Juliet, I'm so sorry. I had no idea you were director of EMS. I mean, I'm just stammering, you know, trying to talk with my foot in my mouth. I said, you know, we'll stand down. Please forgive me for just showing up and saying I'm the director of this thing. I mean, we're here to serve you. We'll stand down. We'll do anything you want. And I'm just kind of babbling. And she looks at me. She says, you really don't have a clue, do you? I said, no, I don't. She said, we begged God to send you. We begged him. You are the answer to our prayers. I will come in here and support you and do anything I can for you. But if you could just keep running this, it would be great. I'm, you know, living in the back of an ambulance right now, and I've got meetings and we're, you know, all over the place. So if you could just own this, that would be amazingly helpful. I said, Julia, I'll do anything for you. But I do have a question. What's with this shirt? Why are you wearing a paramedic shirt? Are you trying to throw off the out of town guys? And she looked me in the eye and she said, Dan, this is the only shirt I own. I just bought a new home and hadn't moved into my new home yet. Both my homes were destroyed and all my belongings, these are all the clothes that I have, and I've been in them for 5 days. And my jaw just went whomp to the asphalt. And I thought, I'm standing in the presence of a hero. You know, here she is working 16 to 18 hour days, living in the back of an ambulance with a bunch of guys, traveling around while they were being shot at, by the way, by some of these rescue, maybe some of the people trapped on top of the buildings. You know, and she's still leaning in and making a difference. And it was just stunning. And I thought, man, I'm in the presence of a hero. I would hope by the grace of God that if I get in a situation like that, that I would show up with the grace and the commitment and the passion that Juliet Sassi has. It was really something to see.
That is amazing. How do you think she does it?
You know, I think she's very clear at the core of who she is on what her purpose is. She understands her purpose, and she has this attitude. I look at, after thinking about how this happens, I think there's two dimensions to it. One has to do with purpose, and the other has to do with power. So some people, when the tough times come, they say, well, I don't have any power. What can I do? You know, I remember watching this woman being interviewed by CNN, and she's screaming at the reporter, when is George Bush going to bring me my food? And I'm going, he's not. George is busy. Really? Because victims will think that somebody else has the power. They don't have any power. How could you expect anything out of them? But the other dimension of besides power is purpose. And this woman, as she's screaming at CNN, is holding her little daughter's hand and not saying, when is George Bush going to bring my daughter some food? This victim mindset is all about me. I don't have any power. Who's going to take care of me? It's not at all. I got to do something to help these other people. So the victims become the powerless takers. The thrivers like Juliet are the powerful givers. It's a simple four quadrant model. Upper right hand corner is the thriver mindset, the powerful giver. Lower left hand corner is the victim, the powerless taker. Upper left hand corner are the controllers, the powerful takers. They were the ones shooting at the rescue people, like I mentioned. And, you know, in a disaster zone, we get to study human behavior in its rawest form, and it's really easy to see it and say, well, that's a dumb idea. Why would you shoot at the rescue people that you're dependent upon for your own rescue? That makes no sense. Why would you do that? You know, and I would never do that. I wouldn't shoot at the rescue people. But then it occurred to me that I shoot comments at people. I shoot looks at people. Occasionally I shoot emails at people where it's all about me. And that was when I had this major epiphany that it's not four different types of people, it's four different mindsets. And I use all four. The fourth one, the lower right, the powerless giver is the bystander. And there's times in my life where I stand by and I go, oh, somebody should do something. Doesn't occur to me it should be me. So you got the bystander, the victim, the controller, and the thriver. And Juliet was really all about, how can I help? So, you know, she saw herself as having the power to make a difference. It wasn't about her. She could care less about who gets the credit. She just wanted to get the work done and take care of her people. And if you talk to the EMS crews that worked for her, they would say, you know, she was unbelievable. And she would do anything for them.
I think in your writing, you've also talked about the difference between thinking about resistance versus thriving. Is this an example of that?
Yeah, you know, it's which way do you face? And this is very, very important. And it's almost hard to talk about. Because if you don't walk in our shoes, you have the potential to misunderstand this. But our mascot during Katrina, and man, you know, hopefully I don't get a bunch of hate mail for this. Our mascot for Katrina was a rubber chicken. And we had our rubber chicken. We took some white athletic tape and taped it to the top of a Bellman's cart that somebody had dropped off at the parking lot. And we were using that as a makeshift wheelchair. We duct taped a chair to it because all our wheelchairs got taken by the guys in the helicopters. They would just pick the patients up and take the wheelchair with them in the helicopter. And so we had this Bellman's cart and it was great, but we had this rubber chicken duct taped to the top of it. And when people would come into that triage area, they're carrying all their belongings and they're sagging, kind of like the refugees in Fiddler on the Roof, where they're just trying to get out and they're just down and moving slowly. And they would look up and they'd go, is that a rubber chicken? And we'd go, yeah, it's a rubber chicken. They go, that's hilarious. Why do you have a rubber chicken? And we said, so you do that. And they would stand a little bit taller and they would walk out to the helicopter a little bit lighter. And I know when I go in a disaster, if I can play a light game, it keeps my peripheral vision intact. When I become focused on the problems and I become negative, like in COVID, you know, there's so much negative. If I sit and watch the news, I'll just get narrower and narrower and narrower and narrower vision. And then I start making mistakes, or at least I don't see the opportunities that are in front of me. If I can focus back, have a little bit of joy in the midst of the suffering. I'm not at all saying that the suffering is not significant. I'm just saying that if I focus on the suffering, my vision, my hearing, and my thinking all become narrow. And in order for me to serve those people, I need to find some joy in something that I can celebrate. One of the greatest ways of doing this is using appreciative inquiry, developed by David Cooperrider. Out of Case Western. And, you know, he did a study looking at the Cleveland Clinic, and he sent two groups of researchers in. One group said, what's wrong? What are your biggest challenges? The other group went in and said, what are you celebrating? What's great? What are your major breakthroughs? Tell us about the highlights of working here. The first group came back and said, we don't think there's any hope for the Cleveland Clinic. We'll give them maybe 5 years. But they're circling the drain. There's no hope for this place. The other group came back and said, these guys are the most innovative, enthusiastic. They're like going to blow the Mayo Clinic out of the water. Same organization, just different questions, because they were facing a different direction. So if I can work with an organization, when I go in, if I'm doing consulting and speaking and doing workshops and coaching, I want to know what's the best of what was. What's the best of what is, and how can we take those things, celebrate them, and then think about the best of what could be? It's a completely different way of looking at it. And it's the interesting thing is we as physicians are trained problem solvers. So for example, if we look at falls, you know, if you're looking at one of the hospitals I was working with was in the bottom 25th percentile for falls in the United States. And, you know, the feds get after you if you have too many people falling. So they formed a fall committee. I said, well, what do you do at a fall committee? Do you all get together and fall down? You know, I mean, do you sing ashes, ashes, we all fall down? You know, that came from the plague, by the way. It's like, what do you do at a fall committee? Well, here's what they came up with. Their solution after several meetings was mandatory nurse rounds. Every hour, 24 hours a day. So they come in and say, hey, Michael, wake up. Do you have to pee or poop? Don't get up without me. Every hour, 24 hours a day. So after a couple of days, the patients are going, what's with you guys, man? I'm sick. I just want to sleep. Would you leave me alone? Do you have a fetish or something? And after a couple of weeks, the nurses are going, this is ridiculous. I don't have time for this. I don't have time for this dumb extra charting that's meaningless. And so the nurses are going in and say, hey, Michael, if you get out of bed and hurt yourself, they're never going to find your body. It doesn't work. So what happens to the fall rate when you have a fall committee? At best, it will stay the same. At worst, it could even get worse. So what about if you asked a different question? If you just flip it and say, what's the positive opposite of falling? It's not falling. The positive opposite is patients get up safely, right? And they get up and they can move around and they can do it and they don't get hurt. So they're up moving. So how do we get people up moving and have that be safe? And then you ask the question of, so what is this really all about? What this is really about is patient mobility. Well, so if we say, how do we improve patients' mobility safely? That's a completely different committee than the fall committee. The fall committee's got alarms on the beds and they're tying people into the bed. The patient mobility committee is, how do we get you up and moving? I had a quadruple bypass just a couple of days over a year ago. The day after my surgery, I was up walking. They sawed me in half, and I'm still up walking. It's a different approach. So what do we do about physician burnout? If you ask that question, you're going to get more burned out. Cooper Ryder said that organizations go in the direction of what they study. But as physicians, we're problem solvers. We know if we got a burnout problem, what we need to do is we need to take a history. We need to find out what the predisposing factors are. We need to know what makes it better, what makes it worse. We need to do the epidemiological study of why we have burnout. Really? And then we need to do some sort of a survey to figure out where we are so we can measure our success. So we do a burnout inventory. When the burnout inventory comes back and it says 52% of the people are burned out, then everybody starts slapping their foreheads and saying, oh my gosh, I thought I was the only one. It's not me. This is a toxic place. I need to get out of here, or maybe I need to get out of medicine altogether. We go in the direction of what we study. Instead of using a burnout inventory, if we flip it and we use the PERMA survey, you know, PERMA is based on the work done by Martin Seligman, and then Michelle McQuaid added on the H at the end. So it's positive emotions, engagement, relationships, finding meaning at your work, a sense of accomplishment, and your health. So let's focus in that direction. How do we develop a vibrant culture where people are looking out for each other, they're connected to each other, and they're taking good care of each other? My big question I keep coming back to is, what does unstoppable love look like? You know, when I think back to Juliet Saucy, what I see is unstoppable love. I have the power to make a difference. It's not about me, and I don't care who gets the credit. What happens if the culture at your organization, if that becomes the lifeblood? I have the power to make a difference. It's not about me, and I don't care who gets the credit. How do we create that type of a culture is so much better than, what are we going to do about physician burnout? So yeah, what direction we face is hugely important. I've discovered this on my mountain bike. Yeah, there's a couple of places where I mountain bike where there's a pretty tight spot between the trees. If I look at it and I say, I'm not going to hit the tree, I hit the tree. It's this principle of target fixation. They teach it to motorcycle riders too. I proved it one time at Devil's Gulch over in Eastern Washington. I was flying downhill and we got to this narrow part of the trail where it was straight up on the left side and about a 30 degree incline down for about 200 feet to the right. And just for a second, I asked myself, I wonder if this target fixation thing is real. Bad time. I launched. Fortunately, there was a shrubbery sticking out with a hat tip to Monty Python and Holy Grail there, by the way, and snagged my front tire on it. And my buddies didn't see me go. They went zinging by, and they finally realized I wasn't down there, and they came riding back up. And then they found me dangling from this bush. Otherwise, I'd still be there. we go in the direction that we look. So we have to be exquisitely aware of that. Even just on an individual level, if my internal conversation is COVID-19 sucks, my practice sucks, this whole thing is miserable. How am I going to get through this? This is, you know, I'm just exhausted all the time. If I start keeping an Eeyore's list where it's all the things that are bad, I feel exhausted by the end of the day. And I've experimented on this thing so many times over the past couple of months, because I'm not telling you I have this mastered. It takes work over and over and over and over and over again. When I catch myself focusing on the darkness, I want to stop and then redirect myself. Viktor Frankl said between stimulus and response is a space. In that space is our freedom. In that space is our power to choose, and it's where we find our freedom and our growth. Stimulus and response, space. So that's the kind of stuff I'm working on personally, quite diligently right now, is what direction am I looking? Because I know I'm going to go there.
But you've taken stuff from disasters for your own personal to learn from disasters, and I assume for your practice as well. But I know as the last couple of years, you've been really trying to take it out well beyond your own personal practice to other organizations. Can you talk about how that happened?
Yeah. Oh, I have a passion for this work, man.
Tell me about it.
I'm doing these, you know, especially now. I've got a whole studio set up at home and we're doing online workshops. So I just did a 2-day workshop for one of the healthcare systems in the Midwest, had with about 30 hospitals in their system. We brought their Physician Leadership Academy online and spent 2 days looking at how do you become more resilient? How do you change the direction that you're looking? How do you take the best of what was and what is and figure out the best of what could be? And it's a dynamic experience. So back in October, I went and became certified as a guide through an organization called X-Change. There's no E, it's just X-Change. And they've done big summits with organizations like the United Nations and British Airways and Facebook and BMW and NASA. And I think they're the best facilitators on the planet. So I went and got certified through them. And we have a very dynamic online community that I'm a part of. And so we debrief our experiences, and we're learning exponentially right now on how do we create an online experience where everybody has a voice, everybody's engaged, and people walk out saying, wow, I feel more connected. I got my hope back. I got my enthusiasm back. I got my joy back. And I made some new friends. I've been working with these people for 5 years and now they're my friends. It's so transformational. It's really fun. And frankly, I weave some of my content in, but the majority is me getting out of the way and allowing people to discover the stuff for themselves. And build these relationships and have some powerful conversations with each other.
It also sounds like, in some sense, you've found your yet even higher purpose by putting on these types of events. Is that right?
Yeah. Well, you know, for me, my practice, if you could put two words, if you could put one word on it, it would be agape. This overarching, why am I doing what I'm doing, is agape, which is usually translated out as unconditional love. But I think it's been mistranslated. I prefer the translation unstoppable love, because unconditional love is a bit too passive for me. Unstoppable love is I'm coming to you because I care. So yeah, this has been just a chance for me, such a wonderful opportunity to be able to take this unstoppable love and bring it into organizations and then watch it spread throughout the organization. It's such rewarding work, especially now, because people, over and over again, what I'm hearing from people is, by the end of the day, I'm so exhausted that I can hardly get out of my chair. And when I poll audiences on that, almost everybody's hand goes up. Yeah, I'm so exhausted. And the other thing that I'm hearing over and over again is I feel disconnected from people. And with these online workshops, it's like giving people an energy boost and a massive connection experience.
And that's so important right now, more than ever.
Oh, Yeah, it's so rewarding. If I can help organizations do that and watch this spread throughout the organization, I believe that culture doesn't start at the top. I believe culture starts at the heart. And it spreads from me to the rest of my team. And then when I can rally my team and say, hey, come here, I got an idea. What do you think we could do if we didn't care who got the credit? How can we make these other teams successful around us? You know, like the lab, like billing. Nobody ever says, how can we make billing more successful? How can we make their lives better? What would happen to the billing people if you reached out to them and said, are there two or three things I can do to make your life better? They're going to fall right off their chair. They're going to write their family members and say, you won't believe what happened today. Some doctors came in and said, what can we do to make your life better? I mean, how do we show up? What happens if unstoppable love starts spreading contagiously through an organization? Change culture starts within my heart, spreads to my team, from my team to the organization, and it can transform the organization. And it's important work because it's not just about us. It's about our team, and it's also about our patients, and it's also about the community. And now when you look around, it's also about the world. The world is crying out right now for hope. It's crying out for connection.
So we're at the half hour point. I want to thank you for joining me today. Did you have any final thoughts or reflections you want to share before we close out today?
I just want to say thanks. I'm so grateful for this opportunity to share my heart with you and spend some time with you. And again, I want to thank you for all the work you're doing for the coalition and for the podcast. I appreciate you tremendously, my friend.
Well, thank you so much. And I appreciate you not just for today, but for all that you do and continue to do every day as well. So thank you so much.
Thank you.
Well, that's our show for today. I want to thank Dr. Dan Diamond for joining us today and for sharing both his insights and personal story. You can learn more about Dan or reach him through his website, www.dandiamond.com. That's www.dandiamond.com. If you wish to learn more about the Coalition, please visit our website at www.forphysicianwellbeing.org. You can also check us out on LinkedIn, Twitter, and Facebook. I want to thank our volunteers and the staff from the Coalition who made this podcast possible. Finally, I would like to thank Acesis, A-C-E-S-I-S, Incorporated, for sponsoring my time working on this podcast. The views and opinions expressed in this podcast are those of the host and his guests and do not necessarily reflect the views of the Coalition for Physician Wellbeing, its board, or other members of the Coalition. I'm your host, Dr. Michael Brown, wishing our caregivers out there meaning, purpose, and joy in the practice of medicine. Together we are stronger. Until next time.